When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and this is Next Question. I really like Kelly Ripa, and I'm guessing some of you listening really like her, too. After all, she has been welcomed into living rooms, bedrooms, kitchens, and morning routines for more than 2 decades as the co-host of ABC's morning talk show, Live, first with Regis Philbin.
Now here's daytime's new dynamic duo, Regis Philbin and Kelly Ripa.
Then with Michael Strahan.
It's Live with Kelly and Michael.
And now with Ryan Seacrest. On the show and in person, Kelly has always been funny, warm, and self-effacing. And it turns out she's exactly the same way as a writer. Her first book, a collection of memoir-ish essays called Livewire, Long-Winded Short Stories, is out now. And we had such a fun time chatting about her career, her family, and the curious ways our worlds and jobs have overlapped. So enjoy. Can I just say, I'm so excited to see you. I loved your book.
Thank you. I loved your book.
And
so
I know how meaningful it is when someone says sincerely and honestly that they loved your book. Because I felt like I got to know you better. I just really enjoyed being in your world. I thought you were so funny. Because, well, obviously, you're really funny. Your last chapters honestly made me cry because made me think of my kids. You write all about Cindy Joaquin off and kind of being in this phase of your life as an empty nester. So I'm really excited to be here to talk to you about it. And I think one of the many things I learned about you in the book, Kelly, is that you're actually introverted and you're shy. And you don't really love social occasions. And then I thought about the times, the occasions I have had the opportunity to be with you socially. And I thought, oh, that's so funny because Kelly's actually kind of shy and not super outgoing at these things. And yeah. It made me realize, you know, everybody's sort of insecure. And I feel shy sometimes at these
you
things.
You do?
I do. I feel... you know, I feel once in a while kind of just uncomfortable in my skin or, you know, or do I have somebody to talk to? You know, all those
yeah.
things that I think everybody feels, no matter who you are. But the fact that you're kind of agoraphobic, actually, was really surprising to me.
It's funny. I almost, as you now know from knowing me, I think that the 2 times I went out this year, you were at both events.
Yeah.
Big events.
Yeah.
I am really just a homebody. I come from a family of homebodies. I think it's definitely like a hereditary skill set.
But I also think it's sort of how you're wired, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm hardwired to just prefer the comfort of under my bed. Under the sheets. I mean hiding under my bed.
But I also would think, Kelly, so much of your job is being out there and mm-hmm. being outspoken and mm-hmm. sharing that when you have your alone time, you don't necessarily want to be like, blah.
Yeah, I just feel like there's as you know, when you host a morning show, you're in people's houses every day. They get to see you. You know, I think of it as a high honor to be welcomed into people's living rooms and breakfast tables still. in this day and age with so many other options, the fact that we are still chugging away and we're still there and people are still welcoming us is a high honor. I don't take that for granted. It's not lost on me that there are so many other choices they could make, but they still tune in for us. But at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, and now people need a break from me. So I try to, you know, be as invisible as possible when I'm not there. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't go to movie premieres, and I don't go to fashion events, and I don't go to all of that stuff because I value my off time, but I also value, like, giving. America needs a break.
I don't know if people feel that way, but I think it's also because it's been very important for you to have some separation between your home life and your work life.
Yeah, I've always prioritized my home life the most because I feel like that's where my real work was. You know, I wanted to, and I'm very much like you. I know you and I were frequently the only moms at the track field.
Right, right.
The only, you know, felt like winter, but it was fall, and we'd be the only ones standing there because I feel like when you're a working woman and sometimes the morning routine, you have to miss a lot. You are forced to miss a lot. So those events that you can attend, you are super attentive, right? And at the end of the day, I was really trying to raise good people, responsible people, conscientious people. And I feel like we are, you know, in that respect, thank God, I take nothing for granted, but so far they've really held up their end of the bargain.
Well, I like that quote from Jackie Kennedy that says, if you bungle raising your kids, nothing else really matters.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you and Mark have done a great job raising good human beings.
We've been very fortunate.
You know, but I think it also...
We put the work in.
Yeah, you put the work in. It comes from good parenting. And
well, we had good parents. I mean, our parents are... I mean, they're very funny.
I'm so lucky.
Yeah.
And you're so lucky.
So lucky.
Although your mom, I wondered if she... I felt like you didn't write about your mom that much. And I wish I'd gotten a little more sense of your mom. You thanked her at the end of the book, but I thought it was funny when you told her you were going to go to therapy. She said, are you going to spend a lot of money trashing me, basically?
Basically, yeah. And she's very anti-therapy.
Yeah. Well, I think generationally, yes. My mom was too. I think nobody even knew about therapy, much less talked about it from our parents' generation.
Exactly.
But I wondered if your mom, like, wanted you to write a little bit more about her.
So I'll give you the heads up on my mom.
Kelly gives us the lowdown on her mom and why she chose not to write about her in this book. That's right after this.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'll give you the heads up on my mom. Number one, let me just say, this is not a memoir.
It's just a collection of
short stories. So, you know, if I ever do crawl out of the hole of being overwhelmed from writing this book, of course I would write about my mom in totality. My mom is very much like everything I wrote about her, I would read to her and then she'd be like, get rid of that, get rid of this, get rid of that. Like, she didn't want me to talk about her at all. She's like, she takes my introversion and turns it like 100 degrees up. But when I asked her, because we're currently living with my parents right now, which is funny because I—
And your mom?
She's great. She's doing so well. She had heart surgery. She's making such an amazing recovery. Her doctors and nurses have been extraordinary. And it's very funny because you go from empty nesters and then suddenly, like, your nest is full. But
right.
with older people
but
who are like—
But that's so nice it's, for them.
It's so
and
nice for
all you.
Of, it's nice for all of us. We're really enjoying their characters. And so I said to my mom, Mom, have you read my book yet? And she said, no, I'm not going to read your sex book. And I said, what? What are you talking about? What? I didn't write a sex book. She goes, well, not according. And now right away, I know that my aunts are sending her the headlines,
oh my
right?
God.
From whatever, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
Google alert or whatever it is, right? So she said, you've written a sex book and I don't want to read about you doing you know what with you know who. And I said, it's not a sex book. As a matter of fact, there's very little sex in this book. It's just to advance a story in the order in which it happened, and there's a disclaimer at that chapter. If you're related to me in any way, please skip to the next chapter. Don't read this, you know. So I was very conscientious in writing, but she proved my most challenging, almost as challenging as my daughter Lola, who wanted me to take out any and all references to her.
Yeah.
But so you know, it's. I wrote this very thoughtfully with people in mind, and I didn't want to put in anything that they found objectionable. So, you know, that's
yeah.
why there's not so much of my mom, because she was
Isn't
like—
Isn't that funny? I don't
yeah.
know your mom, but I was like, I feel a little protective of Kelly's mom,
yeah,
no. I guess, because
yeah, of course.
I think you all obviously have this great relationship.
My mom is probably the funniest person any of us will ever know.
Yeah.
But I don't even think she thinks she's funny. She's being completely serious and deadpan about everything she says.
Well, why, you know, you say it's not a memoir. It is a collection of short stories.
Long-winded
short stories.
Yes.
And I love the title and the secondary title, whatever you call it. How did you find the connective tissue that would, you know, first of all, I guess, enabled you to pick what you were going to write about, but that would make sense for the reader.
So there were 200 more pages in this chapter, and a lot was cut out.
You mean in the book?
In the book, there were 200 more pages. So there's a lot that was taken out. My editor, Carrie Thornton, God love her, this woman, she stacked the book. I had the book completely stacked differently. I had it more chronological in its order.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, let me stack these chapters the way I feel they connect, because you're too close to this book at this point.
Right.
I really wanted to start backwards with the last chapter and work my way to the beginning. And she was like, you now, because you've written, now you think you're also an editor. And you don't know what you're doing. And I said, did you read the chapter on asshole syndrome? Now I'm an editor too.
Yeah,
it's like anything
yeah.
if I see it, then I believe that I can do it. And I, you know, having read so many great books by so many great authors, yours included, I, you know, I mean, thank God, and I think I told you this when you came on my show. Thank God. Your book came out when I had essentially finished my book. Because if I had read your book, I wouldn't have written my book.
Oh,
does that
come
make
on.
No, I wouldn't. I would have been like, I can't. I'll never write a decent word in my life. I'll never write anything decent. It's not good. It's not. But ignorance really is bliss sometimes. And so I, like, blissfully and ignorantly went into this saying, I've read books, therefore I can write books.
Well, you know, I think you sell yourself short, Kelly. First of all, I think you're a really fun, clever writer. I wish I had dog-eared some of the pages. Because, you know, it's very uniquely you. So I don't want you to sell yourself short that way.
Well, it's funny. I would send the chapters as I would write them. And some of them were written and rewritten and rewritten. Like, I'm sure you felt the same way. I would write a chapter five or six times before I found it.
Yeah.
Right? And I would send it to Mark, who was mercifully living in Vancouver at the time. So people will say to him, you know, was it hard for you while she was writing this book? And he says, no, she was great. And I said, he has no idea how insufferable I was.
Yeah.
You know, for our 45-minute discussions a day, I would turn on all the charm and try to hide the hideousness of the self-doubt and the me pacing around the bedroom and trying to, like, construct a sentence. But I would send the chapters to Mark first. He was sort of my pre-editor.
Right.
And he would call me back, FaceTime me back, and he would say, wow, I thought this chapter was going to be about something else entirely. I didn't see that coming. And that's when I would know I got it right.
Yeah.
You know, I waited for him to say, oh my gosh, that's the funniest thing. Or how did you remember that? How do you recall that? And I would say, you know, when I write in those journals at night and you think that I'm just like making lists of things I have to do, that's what I'm doing. I'm actually writing down the things that I want to remember for. And it was Andy Cohen who told me to do that many years ago, years and years ago.
I remember Gene Shalit. I think I might have mentioned this in my book. I can't even remember, Kelly, what's in it and what's not. That Gene Shalit said, you should talk into a tape recorder. When I got my job on the Today Show, he said, every day, talk into a tape recorder. Just talk about, like, what the day was like, what an interview was like. I was like, Gene, that is such a good idea. And, of course, I never did it.
Well,
and I'm not a journaler either. So it was, but thank God for the internet.
Right.
Because I could retrieve so much. Thank God I'm a pack rat, because I could look back on speeches and my calendars and all sorts of other things that reminded me. But Andy was a really good friend to have you do that. And I'm sure it was extremely helpful in writing the book. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Mark, because obviously you guys have an incredible relationship.
We do.
Which is so nice. So nice to see. And I know you wrote about, you know, we were not supposed to make it and people in show business. But I do think you guys are both very much mired in your respective values of your families.
Yeah.
And but I did laugh at when you first met him, and it was when you were on All My Children, and he was coming in to audition for
a role.
And you saw his headshot, and basically he had you at not even hello.
No, it wasn't even hello.
He had you at the headshot.
He had me at Mark Consuelos, actor.
And then you come out in curlers. I think you had zip medicine,
didn't you? I had toothpaste because I had tried every other remedy.
Yeah.
And did you have
curlers, too?
I had those giant Velcro rollers. You know, the ones that look like Coke bottles.
Oh, yeah.
So I had those because, you know, we always say, like, on a soap opera, the bigger the hair,
the higher the ratings.
The closer to Emmys. closer to an Emmy you get. So I had these Coke bottle rollers, and I didn't have any makeup on because I was, like, for some reason, my scenes were at the end of the day, and it's, like, it's not a first come, first serve. It's like whoever's up first, you're in makeup first. So no makeup on. This giant pimple, because why wouldn't I? And I had covered it with Colgate toothpaste. But Colgate on, we decided for some reason at the soap that Colgate was the best for getting rid of zits when all else fails.
All right. Noted.
No, right. And so I walk in and he is there because he was brand new to show business. He had never auditioned for anything, and here he was screen testing for a soap opera. And he had no idea what a screen test was. Same as me. When I screen tested, I thought it was a written exam, and I'm not kidding. I'm no longer at that place in my life where when now I'm brave enough to say, no, I'm sorry, I don't know who or what you're talking about.
And I also love that you've discovered how to say, no, that doesn't work for me.
No, that doesn't work for me.
Which I can't really do, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
I'm going to send you my therapist's name and phone number, and she'll make you practice in front of a mirror.
You know, you can't even say, no, I'm sorry, that doesn't work for me.
No, you have to take the I'm sorry out, but you try to.
I can't do that.
No. I learned how to do it, but it took, and I'm not kidding.
No, that doesn't work for me.
No, that doesn't work for me.
That sounds so cold and mean.
But it's not. It's not cold or mean. It's something that people say to us all the time. They're usually men, and so I think it's not just the nature of our business, because I've been on a book tour, so I'm meeting people from all sorts of industries that have really dialed into that particular chapter, because they are utilizing my "no, that doesn't work for me." And it, guess what? You know, this is free advice. It's not a self-help book, but this is free advice. I spent thousands of dollars on therapy to learn to say, "No, that doesn't work for me." But again, it was hard for me. I had to practice and practice. I kept saying, "No, I'm so sorry." And she would say,
"Maybe
stop.
Next time. Maybe yes. Ask me yes. Next year.
Ask me, yes, ask me in a year." Because they will. They'll ask you in a year. They mark it down.
Even my husband was like, "Don't say that, because they're going to come back and you're going to have to say no again."
Exactly. And so I was in this place where I was saying yes, 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 or, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. That doesn't work because I have 87 other conflicts. But, you know, if there's some other day, oh yes, we'll work around your schedule. You tell us what day you don't have 87 other things." So when you say, "No, that doesn't work for me," it sort of stops any and all advancement of any other conversation. And it works like a charm. It works 100% of the time, 100% of the time.
All right, I'm going to try it. All right, no, but that doesn't work for me.
You're going to have to practice it in the mirror. I can see you already vacillating. You're formulating that "I'm so sorry."
Because I'm a pleaser.
I understand. And I, too, am a reformed pleaser. It's like there should be a self-help.
Pleasers
yes.
Anonymous.
Pleasers Anonymous, PA.
Hi, my name is Katie, and I'm a pleaser.
Yes.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Katie.
But getting back to Mark and yes. The Colgate on your face, yes. Did you really do a tap dance when you first saw him?
I mean, I did a verbal tap dance.
Oh, I thought you kind of were like.
No, I mean, that was what I was doing. It was like, huzzah. You know, I was like, "Oh my gosh, ha cha cha cha." I really said to him, I vomited words at him. He was spellbound.
Not in a good way.
He was spellbound, and he doesn't recall what I looked like at all. He always goes back to, "I was just trying to get a job, and I was warned that actors were strange, and so you just seemed like a strange actor." And I was like, "Did I?" You know, but I was so, I wanted to engage him in some way and let him know that, you know, I look at how low maintenance I am. I'm the girl with the Colgate on her face and the Coke bottle rollers in her hair, totally comfortable with my future husband seeing me this way. Isn't that funny?
But it's wonderful that, you know, that you guys did connect, that he wasn't like security.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
right?
I mean, first of all, he should have filed a restraining order. But second of all, it was this weird thing where I knew. Again, I'm not a believer in love at first sight. I've never been a hopeless romantic. I'm like very pragmatic. I'm a practical lady, you know. It's so funny. I never decorated a dressing room ever in my life until like my 15th year at Live. My 15th year at Live, I decorated my dressing room because I was like, I think they're going to
care. You're gonna,
they're probably just going to carry me out, or maybe TV will end. I don't know. But I was so practical. I never wanted to keep things around that I would have to pack into a box and leave. You know
right.
What I mean? It felt like a waste of time. So people would always walk into my dressing room and say, "Is your dressing room being redecorated?" And I'd say, "No, this is my dressing room. Why? Why do you ask? It's so barren and terrifying looking." And I said, "Well, you never know. Every day could be your last day." So to be a person that suddenly found themselves dreaming that I was married to this person, this complete stranger, and that we were flying to Rome together on an airplane with a baby, made no sense. And then I, the next day at the screen test, as I talk about in the book, I vomited that out at him. I said, "I had a dream. You know,
I had a dream. A beautiful dream, baby."
Okay. And so I told him about this dream, and he was so non-threatened and grown up about the whole thing. And he sort of just, and you know, the room fell into a hush. There were 10 other guys there also auditioning for the role of Mateo, who seemed spellbound by this conversation. He was like not even halfway paying attention. He was writing down blocking and taking notes. And I said, remember me from yesterday?
I'm just so glad it turned out the way it
did. But it shouldn't have. I mean, he should have filed a restraining order. I probably should have been fired. I mean, I broke every rule that, well, I guess they didn't exist yet. It was the freewheeling 90s.
Right.
But it
wasn't the rules.
It wasn't the rules. There were no rules. And so I somehow became his friend. We became friends. And we really started liking each other and respecting each other. And we had read the same books. We found the same, we were both at the time following the Rwandan genocide, and nobody was talking about it except us. So we would talk about it to each other. And, we had a lot of commonalities, even though we grew up very different. Our parents had...
He was born in Spain and raised in Florida.
Well, right? He was born in Spain and then lived in Italy until he was 7. Uh-huh. His father was in special operations for the military. And then they moved to Lebanon, Illinois. And then he went to high school in Florida.
Okay, great.
So he moved around quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was born and raised in the same house my mother was raised in. My grandfather built the house himself. But
the South Jersey stuff really fun.
I was from the south of Jersey.
It was really fun to read that with the accent and the mayor of Easttown. And what you use some words that the way people...
Yeah, like the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to the Eagles game.
And some other things.
Bagels.
Yeah.
You know, or my name, you know, back in high school, they would have called me Kelly Ripa. You know,
With the R, right?
Yes, it's like O's sound like E-U's.
Yeah, yeah.
R's are like it's like a hard.
You do some very funny phonetically.
Yeah, phonetically, it's almost impossible to understand.
Yeah, you say bagel. You say bagel.
Water ice.
Right.
Yeah.
Instead of water
so,
ice.
So, like, imagine taking a spelling test when you're in third
phones,
grade.
Phones. Beans.
Yeah.
Beans.
Yeah. The home phone.
Yeah.
You have a home phone? I have a hard time doing it now.
I love it though because you're so proud of being from South Jersey.
Yeah,
I just
of course.
Love it. I
but
love
now
it.
I'm hearing, you know, people who have read this book, I hear from the North Jerseyers all the time.
Oh, that
they're like, you know, we're not fancy the way you think we are. And I was like, oh, sounds like a little self-defensive to me. Don't hate our blueberries.
After the break, Kelly and I chat about finding our footing in the Media Boys Club.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tier at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much we could talk about, Kelly, but I do want to ask you, obviously,
mm-hmm.
about, just because I think we have a lot in common, being a woman, fulfilling kind of the role of an archetype,
mm-hmm.
being put in a box and sort of not being able to expand outside the borders of that box. But I want to ask you about your live experience, because It was so bizarre to me. Although not really. But, you know, it sounds like the whole thing was fraught. I would say that fraught, at least the beginning of your career at Live, because you were sort of wanted, but sort of not. And it wasn't like it was just this bizarre wooing process that wasn't really wooing, but just kind of like, we've got to fill this role and she's there. And it was a very, it must have been a very strange experience. And I think you capture it really well in the book.
Yeah, thank you.
Kind of what a mind fuck, excuse me, listeners,
it was. Yeah, it was very strange because, you know, I did not know, and again, much like writing a book, ignorance sometimes really is bliss. I was sort of baffled. I did not understand that there were these two separate organizations.
The network, then the show.
And the local affiliate station, WABC, okay? They were partners in this show, but they were the heads of both organizations were enormously distrustful of one another. Less so on the ABC network side and more so on the WABC
side. Because the WABC probably had a bit of an inferiority complex.
Well, I think they also felt like, well, we were broadcasting this show locally. And now here they come and they want to make it a national show. Now they're going to try to control us, or who do they think they are, or whatever. This is me thinking aloud. You know, I'm not representing this in the book. I'm just saying I'm thinking aloud as to what was the basis of this
strange dynamic.
Strange dynamic that I could not possibly understand because I was living under this assumption that we were all on the same channel, so we were all friends and synergy and Disney and la, la, la. And I did not realize that because I was so wanted by the network that I might not be wanted by the WABC faction.
Right.
And I didn't realize that until much farther along.
You know, Lauren, my producer for the podcast, was saying that, you know, Kathy Lee didn't have that issue because she and Regis
came up together. Yeah.
But then he was established. He probably felt, or maybe that contingent felt, they were being big-footed or forced to do something by the network.
Right.
And not necessarily were on board with it. Or, you know, looking back on it, what do you think you could have done to smooth things over a little bit? Do you think, because I think it's not that dissimilar from my experience at CBS, where Les Moonves, the head of entertainment, wooed me, but I never got the complete buy-in by the news division. And I think that if I had politically, and I'm not very political, unfortunately, if I had politically like gone to different people within the news division and really kind of won them over, or at least had the knowledge that they didn't want me there or they didn't want me there, it would have been maybe slightly different. Do you think back on?
I mean, it's so, you know, it's so interesting you say that, and that's why I'm very like careful to point out that it certainly wasn't Regis's fault. You know, I never blame him in this book. I don't blame him at all because he was assigned a co-host.
Right.
And this is a man that had earned his place in show business, and he had, you know, kept that train on the tracks.
So do you think if you had said, I want to make sure Regis is okay with this, that it might have made the transition easier?
I think that I was so unaware that
he wasn't.
It never occurred to me that he would not have the stamp of approval. You know what I mean?
Right.
Even when they said to me, it's not his choice to make, it's our choice. And I was like, but it should be his choice.
Right.
And they said, well, we're not going to force a host upon any other host. You know, and then you realize, like, that's totally untrue. Like, that's exactly what happened. And it makes me feel sad for him. But I think eventually we did, like, have a smooth, like, we smoothed it out. Like, we worked, because I'm a very honest and earnest person. And like you, I am not political. So it never occurred to me that I had to, I didn't even understand the dynamics. Like, who would I have spoken to?
Right.
I thought I was speaking to the people I needed to speak to. And I thought that just me being there and being very deferential and me waiting my turn and taking my place and taking my lumps and accepting responsibilities for things that had nothing to do with me and playing that game, I thought that I was doing all of that. I thought I was doing all of the right things.
You know, this is where I think agents sometimes fall down on the job.
100%.
Where, you know, they're so concerned with salaries, but they don't actually make sure that the environment that they're putting clients in is the right one. And I think the best agents would really, you know, even those who call themselves managers, mm-hmm. would really take it upon themselves to help guide someone and help smooth over these rough edges and have the foresight to understand that this dynamic might not be helpful for their client.
Right. And it seemed to be exactly the previous statement was,
yes,
it's more about the money and the,
yes,
salary. And
well, they're coin operated.
Yes. And it was more about not necessarily being concerned with what was best for me or for Regis, or it was being concerned with the bottom line and not, you know, even it's the times I said, you know, this seems to be very challenging, and I feel like I'm getting abused at least in the tabloid press. I was
right,
very abused, and there was sort of this hands up. Well, there's nothing we can do about it. What do you want us to do about it?
You know, but I know you say that you smooth things over, but it sounds like there were issues all along, and that even when Regis left the show, there was some kind of tension or resentment, or
not that I was aware of.
No. But
it was like, it was like literally after the fact, and like 10 years after the fact.
But saying like to Larry King, misrepresenting,
right,
kind of you, and
you know what,
it seems like he sort of, from my impressions from the book,
yeah,
when you wanted to have a closer relationship, he was a little talk to the hand-ish.
He believed, and because he had done the show for so long, that if you are working together, that is where it begins and ends, and then you have your life out.
Do you think that was the case with Kathy Lee, too?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the nature of their relationship. Again, I think power dynamics,
right,
are very different, and when you're two equals, that's a very different thing than what I was perceived as coming in as a secondary host.
Right.
So I can't, you know, it's like, I can't know that. I don't know what it was like. I just know that these were the rules that were established. Like, the conversations had to be saved for the air.
Right.
And only for the air, you know.
And was he worried that if you had more of a social relationship, it might change the dynamic?
Maybe.
I mean, I remember thinking that with Matt and Bryant, I didn't want to hang out with them. Not that they wanted to hang out with me.
Yeah, right,
but
I
didn't really want to hang out
right
with them, because I thought, what if I get mad? Or what if someone says something? Or what if somebody gets drunk or
right,
misbehaves?
Exactly.
Like,
right,
I don't want that to interfere
right
with our professional relationship.
Well, that's what I said. I was like, only in this day and age is now, like, we had a very professional relationship, and now that is looked at with, like, some sense of scorn.
Right.
And I said, you know, there was a time where that was to be revered, professionalism,
right,
in the workplace, you know. But, it, you know, it's one of those things that I feel like whatever notes we hit correctly. And the reason I transcribed those parts of the book is because I wanted it to be accurate. My opinion or my thought process as to that should not interfere as to the reality of what was said. It's like, these are the facts.
Yeah.
We
and you
saw
kind of
each other. I saw him. He was on our show. But then this interview happened
where he said he hadn't, and
was
they
never invited,
never called.
And so I thought, because I'm an idiot, I thought, well, it's also easily irrefutable. And the press will do its job and say, actually, he was on the show
right
a few months ago. Actually, he's been. And it was like radio silence. That story just spread like wildfire.
Right.
And I was baffled. I couldn't believe it. And I went, I remember going into work the next day and my producers all looked stricken. You know, kind of, they felt bad for me. I think they felt bad for me. Like, I don't,
that it was being so misrepresented.
That it was being so misrepresented.
And I wonder, why do you think Regis did that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I say, in the book, I don't know, and I still don't know.
And you wanted to basically set the record straight.
Yeah.
But
I'm not an
course,
abandoner. I don't abandon people. That's not my thing.
And it's interesting because the reaction, I'm sure the tabloid reaction to this book, which I was sort of warning you of, I think, when I came on the show, where things are taken out of context, twisted, or obviously conflict sells.
Yeah, right.
Right?
But the only reaction to the book was that my husband made me pass out while we were having sex. I mean, that was like, that was the headline of the book.
That's a good story, yeah, which you're going to have to get the book
but
to read.
Really
but
is
needless
like
to say, Mark dressed Kelly in a really bad outfit,
yes,
when she passed out and, mm-hmm, had to go to the hospital.
But that was the big takeaway, and I kept saying.
But what about the Regis stuff? Has that gotten some negative press?
No, just
Kathy Lee comment.
Yeah, that was the only press that it got because I think people read it and understood it, and it was and went, oh my gosh. It all makes sense now.
Yeah.
Like
So you feel like you achieve what you set out to in terms of not the whole book. I'm just talking about that sort of misunderstanding and the fact that you wanted to correct the record.
Yeah,
which
because I think we're entitled to correct the record,
especially if it's
when
the
it's
truth.
Been misrepresented. So that's why I don't represent my opinion. I represent everything in transcripts because I think it's more important to have a transcript on record.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, this is like one chapter. It's like I like people to focus on the book in its totality.
Right.
But I would be remiss if I didn't talk about my transition into that show because it's such a huge part of my life.
Of course.
And,
well, I'm with you, sister.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel the same way about what I wrote about my book and various experiences I had.
It's not a burn book. I don't disparage anyone. I leave the reader, and again, people who have read the book have a very different, you know, it's the reason there were no headlines about that chapter is because it's not headline generating, you know, and people who have read it have this kind of understanding about what it's like to work in a place that it's not like organic.
Right.
Where it's not two people getting to know each other. It's like fast. It happens fast. Everything happens fast, right? And then to have something misrepresented about you in the press, what do you do? Do you just hope it goes away? Or do you set the record straight in real time? That's the whole point of the story, you know, is that.
But was it frustrating? Because I do think there were some headlines, and I think that's what Kathy Lee was responding to, that did misrepresent what you were saying in the book. No?
No, there really weren't. I mean, the headlines were not disparaging. They were not misrepresentative. That's what I was so surprised by. The headlines generated was that reaction to non-headlines.
Right.
So I was sort of fascinated by, oh my gosh, these are headlines that are now based on a non-reader of the book. And before that, there were no headlines. And so it really did, like, ultimately, I think you know this, like, book sales are, it's really a very word of mouth. And I'm not somebody that believes that all PR is good PR.
All press is good press.
Right. I don't believe that.
I don't believe that either.
But when it comes to selling a book, it is.
Apparently
it is, as you know, as you are now aware. And so it's one of those things where I went, oh my gosh, it's so funny. Like, I felt like there was a moment where I couldn't get my book mentioned in Vanity Fair, in, you know, Glamour, in the New York Times. And then suddenly I can. And it's like that's shocking, weird. I go, and here I am again in this conundrum. Do I set the record straight or do I just say thank you? And I chose to say thank you.
One of the things that, you know, you write about and is the fact that you didn't have an office, you didn't have a desk, you had no place to put your computer.
Right.
And
I didn't have a computer either.
You didn't have a computer.
But then I got one.
You know, but it took a while for you to feel like you were
part of things.
Yeah, it sounds like sort of a high school clique that you couldn't penetrate.
Yes.
And it kind of made me mad at Michael Gelman.
You know.
It did. It made me mad. And I was like, okay, he's the executive producer of the show. He should be supporting Kelly. He should be creating a culture where she's welcomed, and it made me mad.
You know, I don't think it's his fault. I really don't. I don't put any responsibility on him. I think it was a way
I'll never be on live again.
No, no,
but
no.
It just really
true.
Upset
that's
me.
That's not true. No, I understand, and a lot of people think, like, they think they put it down to one person, like, well, he's the boss there. There are so many people that were over his head and over all of our heads that worked above us. And, you know, I had and still have a great working relationship with him. And he has to walk a very fine line, a tightrope. That's a tightrope walk, not showing favorites, not picking favorites, not... And like say, and keeping your own job in the process.
Yeah.
It's hard. That's hard work. And anytime something seems easy, it's hard, you know. And so he's been the executive producer of that show for all 872 seasons or whatever it is, you know. And it's like I don't blame him because I think he was doing the best he could in a very delicate situation.
It was also a different time, you know. One
totally.
Of the things that people I think sometimes don't understand, they read things that happened in the past through the lens of the present.
Exactly.
And that was also very profound. That was very Oprah too.
Yes. You know what?
You cannot
you
read
should
about
do
the
this.
Past through the lens of the present.
You should do this for a living. You're very good.
But
no, you're right. But that's why in the book, I keep reminding everyone, if you
like
notice,
women were like, treated kind of like second-class citizens.
And that's the way it was. And I write about it in the context of the time because it's important for people to gather the context of the time. These were not unheard of things. This was not an unusual.
It was a very male-dominated industry.
Yes.
And, you know, and full of big egos.
Yes.
And so it was complicated. So what are you thinking about your future? Are you loving where you are still? You know, as somebody who did a morning show for 15 years and really appreciate it every day, but it started to feel like Groundhog Day at some point.
Always.
Where, like, how many segments about, you know, what are the best genes for your body could I do?
I also think about, you know, the young blood, fresh people coming in. I think about it all the time. I'm very cognizant of that, you know, and I discuss it a lot. You know, every time we have somebody on the show that's young and funny and effervescent, or even, you know, by young, I mean just younger than me, you know, effervescent and interesting.
Curious.
I always turn to Gelman and I'll say, you know, you should look at her you should look at her for, you know, co-host. Like, you know, when I go on vacation, I have her sit in the chair with Ryan. And same with guys. I look at guys and I'm like, you know, you should take a look at this guy, you know, because I'm very cognizant. I believe that as a franchise show, I don't think I'm the host of the show. I don't think the show's a success because of me. I don't think it's a success because of any one person. It is a group effort.
But come on, you're an incredibly important
people
part.
Like continuity.
Mm-hmm.
But they also enjoy that shot in the arm of the, you know, the breath of fresh air. Remember when you were the breath of fresh air?
Yeah.
I remember when I was the breath of fresh air. You know what I mean? I remember that, you know. And so you don't want to be like the
person who stays at the party.
You don't
want to
be the hot breath.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
The bad breath.
The garlic breath.
That stayed around too long.
Exactly.
But when you think about it, you think like, 5 years, 2 years, or do you think like that?
I don't. I mean, I think if I thought like that, I would really, you know, if I thought like in terms of years, it would be really too terrifying. I still would not have gotten past 3 years. You know, if they said 3 years from now, I'd be like, 3 years? It's more of a, I think, you know, when you know, you know. And when they know, you know. And I think it's got to be that group discussion.
And hopefully you know before they know.
Well, I mean, I think I actually think I do know. I'm not willing to actually discuss it, but it could generate all sorts of panic-stricken headlines. But, you know, I have a very good idea. It is, you know, it is definitely like a finite amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, working there.
You're
in
not going to be walking onto the set with a walker.
No, I'm not. It's not a forever job, and nor should it be. You know, everybody should get to, I mean, I wish everybody could experience it and they might have a better comprehension of how difficult it can be
right.
And sometimes is. But it's mostly a high honor to be welcomed into people's homes, you know.
Kelly Ripa's book is called Livewire, Long-Winded Short Stories, and it's out now. Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements and Adriana Fazio. The show is edited and mixed by Derek Clements. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to katiecouric.com. You can also find me at Katie Couric on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do. And start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.